This is Find a Way. Welcome to part two of my conversation with John David Erickson. If you haven't heard part one, go on back and listen now, and then you can rejoin us here as we journey into Zen Buddhism, esotericism, the occult, dreams, and much, much more. This is a conversation I very much hope to pick up again the next chance I get. Stay tuned at the end of the episode for an original song by John David called Passage. Thanks for being here. Enjoy. Tell me about it. I'm okay. So curious. I'm so curious to hear your experience.
So I got into Buddhism like 2011 or so, mm-hmm. and I got way into it. I was almost like evangelizing it in a way. Mm-hmm. When I moved back to Gainesville, like my partner and I ended up separating, and I moved back to Gainesville, and like there's no group meeting to talk about Buddhism. I'm going to set up a meetup, meetup. I'm sure it's still around. I'm going to set up a meetup group to talk about Buddhism, and I like wrote out a little lecture, and I met up with some people at Volta, and I like told them, and like they weren't really into hearing me talk about it, but. eventually
I wish I'd known about that.
And eventually I found groups that were practicing in town, and I found that there was a Zen Buddhist group. So they had their own building, and I had an experience there that made me feel comfortable to continue in that path. Cause a big thing that comes up for people when they study Buddhism is like reincarnation. Like, you get reincarnated. Do you get reincarnated? Like, what does reincarnation mean? And there was a visiting teacher from Tallahassee, and sometimes you get opportunities to have one-on-one private conversations with a teacher. And I said, like, do I have to believe in reincarnation? And she said, like, you only have to believe what you personally experience.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, that's like so liberating.
Right.
And that element of Zen, at least that lineage, being non-dogmatic, that allows a lot of people in, like allows Christians in,
right.
It allows scientific materialist skeptics like me into it. So I ended up getting really into it. I ended up starting to like lead the groups whenever the teacher wasn't available. The teacher, he was working, he was a retired ex-military guy. And he used to work at in women's prisons teaching yoga and meditation. The state of Florida cut his funding, and he just went into grief, and like he like abandoned the group essentially and left. And I ended up being a temporary president of the group, and I started leading it every other week. And at that time in my life, I believed that I had to be very dedicated and like show up to things on a very like. I basically never gave myself a break for years, and eventually I like burned out so badly on leading groups. I was also leading another meditation group that was like more secular.
Okay.
And so I had this experience of like falling in love with like a spiritual tradition, and then putting myself way into it. I didn't really understand boundaries at the time.
I see.
And that's not part of like the teaching, is like there's no teaching about boundaries in at least in that tradition of Buddhism. And so I burned out. I got rid of all my Buddhist books. So I've had this experience that I think other people have had of like finding a tradition, feeling like it really supports my life, and then like falling out of love with it and feeling extremely lost. I don't know what it would have taken for me to want to stay back in it.
Yeah.
I think that the teacher leaving and like never really processing that with the students,
sure,
affected me profoundly. I think I had moved on in that stage of my life from like, okay, I know how to be mindful. Now what do I do with the raw material of my life to make my life better for me, mm-hmm. for myself? And there's an element of at least that Zen lineage where it's so minimalist, it's so hardcore, that there's, and it's so non-dogmatic that it's dogmatic in its own way, mm-hmm. where like I wanted to discuss these like I wanted to like understand not just suffering, but how to create happiness.
Yeah.
And there wasn't really room to talk about that in that context. And had I known at the time that I could have had kept Zen on one, in one, like let Zen be one part of my life and then develop myself in other parts of my life, I could have kept it, but I was putting all my eggs in one basket and I wasn't getting all my needs met from this one tradition.
I see.
And I think that's partly where the burnout came from.
Yeah.
So I ended up keeping a meditation practice that I kind of modified over time. I added some like stuff I learned about Qigong into it.
Mm-hmm.
But basically keeping with a mindfulness meditation practice. However, getting back to the pandemic, and this is where I got into Western esoteric tradition. When the pandemic hit, as it was for everybody, it was just like really, you know, horrible for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
I made the decision to live alone.
Mm-hmm.
And just the experiencing isolation, that degree of isolation for the first time in my life, it I had done a little bit of volunteering in prisons and I understood like I understood at least conceptually what prisoners go through in terms of like their psychological struggles, but it was like this is a very comfortable place with great food. But yet I'm having some of these experiences that prisoners had of this profound isolation. And sure. And just the way, like I got to the point where I could no longer, like I was so traumatized that I couldn't play like 8-4 bars of music without like making 6 mistakes.
Wow.
Like I was so out of it.
Wow.
And so I was like, okay, I need something.
Yeah.
Meditation is not sufficient. I need something else. So I was like, who's a teacher out there that has this experience of being a prisoner, and what did they do to get through prison? And at that point, I had listened to, I had watched the episodes of the Midnight Gospel that came out right as the pandemic hit, mm-hmm. and we talked about this a little bit. And one of the guests on the show is Damien Eccles.
Yes.
Yeah. And did you end up watching that?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, you saw that episode. And just briefly, Damien. In the 90s, for people who don't know him, in the 90s, he was like into Metallica and he liked to check out spooky books in the library. And there was a murder in his town in West Memphis, Arkansas. And like the three kids or the four kids that wore like Metallica shirts were basically scapegoated.
Right.
And he was put in a death row. And so he talked about in death row, he studied with a Zen teacher. And it like was fine, but then he discovered this other path, and what convinced him to go down this other path is like he got into the teachings of a group from the late 1800s, early 1900s called the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. They use these were folks that were like middle class, primarily living in England. So they had like Anglican backgrounds or Episcopalian backgrounds. And so they used Christian and Judeo-Christian imagery in their practices. And Damien said like, okay, well, I'm not really Christian, but like as a little kid, I was exposed to this imagery. So I have this, I'm paraphrasing him here. I have this like symbol set in my mind, like deeply baked into me of like angels and the cross and like all these symbols that are like a deep part of my like spiritual DNA. And why not use those in a creative way to like have a spiritual practice that like I can kind of create myself? And that's basically what he did. And it was like, oh, well, I was Catholic. I grew up like being scared of like seeing apparitions of the Virgin Mary and angels manifesting, which is what people were experiencing in South America.
Right.
Like I have this baked into me too. Why don't I experiment with this myself? And I found out that Damien like was posting lectures on YouTube, and he had a Patreon, and you could have Zoom meetings with him, and there was a Facebook group, and he had written books.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah, and so there was a lot of like little occult Zoom groups like that. And they're still active, but they were probably more active during the pandemic, during like the lockdowns. And so I got into it, and I like things that have like a lot of depth that I can kind of get lost in.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think that's part of why I like jazz, is because I feel like I'll never get good at it. Like I'll never get to a point where like, okay, I'm done, I can move on. Like it's just like there's just infinite depth, and I have like an intense personality, and I like just like dig deeper and deeper and deeper forever. That's how the Western esoteric tradition feels like to me, because it's like all these different sources that have kind of cross-pollinated over the centuries and been driven underground by the Catholic Church.
Right.
So like we're talking like Babylonian and Sumerian and Greek, Egyptian, Jewish, and then like some of this knowledge got transferred into like Arabic speaking folks during the Middle Ages and kind of like fermented there, and they got brought back into Europe. And it's cool to see that there's like a non-dualist mystic philosophy, like Eastern traditions in some way, but closer to home.
Yeah,
that we can relate to, but yet it still feels really wild and exotic in some places as well.
That's been so transformative for me as well. So I was also raised Catholic.
Yeah,
and being able to recognize, and this is something I think a lot of people look over, or at least I certainly looked over it for a long time, but being able to recognize that these are, you know, memes that have been created within us, you know, these like symbols that have been repeatedly presented to us over and over, to the point that we can't escape them. You know, our minds have been programmed with them, not, you know, so when I think of like the Virgin Mary, to be able to sit back and say like, well, okay, it doesn't have to be the Virgin Mary that is in the story, you know, it doesn't have to go along with every detail of belief. The Virgin Mary is a representation of a force or a representation of an idea.
That's right.
And all the symbols have these things, and just there have been so many moments of you know, recognizing. I think I mentioned in my conversation with Darby the recognition of like the concept of the Trinity, you know, when it comes to its relationship to consciousness. You know, there this idea that there is a perhaps like a source code of objective reality that interacts with us, and then through us we get a projected reality, and so we have this like Father, Son, and Spirit, you know, idea. It just reignites all this stuff that for so long I pushed down and I kind of wanted to be rid of and wanted to let go of. And it actually my disconnection from Catholicism was an ugly one. You know, it was one of, I was angry about it and I was disgusted by it. And I felt so stupid that I bought into it. And I carried a lot of shame about it, and not just shame about, you know, me believing in it, but also shame about disappointing family members who wanted me to stay in it. And, you know, and thinking about people who never believed in it, who might have judged me for believing in it, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
To come around sort of full circle to it now, to where I have a real appreciation for it. Even the belief system, even the things that I no longer connect with word by word, but I can connect to it with this bigger meaning behind it, these like basic truths, or maybe I shouldn't use the word truth, but these basic concepts that all of a sudden ring true within me, you know, and that's been kind of wild. That I, you know, if you told me 20 years ago that's where I would be with these symbols and these stories, I wouldn't have believed.
Do you ever feel like going back to Mass?
Yes.
Yeah.
Totally. I would. And it's funny, I do it when I travel sometimes.
Interesting.
When I was in a couple of
cathedral or something.
Right. You know, I'm drawn to the cathedrals for sure, no matter what. But if I get a chance to catch a Mass and like sit in the back, so I can get up and leave if I have to.
Yeah.
But that's wonderful to me, and it's such a better experience sitting there observing it with curiosity instead of sitting there like, I hope nobody gets angry. I have to look for it. I have to listen to everything. I have to. It's just what you're describing in the previous discussion in a small room playing music. The pressure to believe and to pay attention and to focus and to not dawdle or play with my thumbs or whatever it is. How could anybody feel anything in there with that kind of pressure?
Yeah, that's right.
So it's funny that they suppress the curiosity so harshly.
Yeah. Part of the reason I really got into Buddhism is because I enjoyed the ritual of Catholic Mass, and so with like the Buddhist practices that I had, I would go to these retreats where like you had to eat your meals in a precise fashion and like,
oh wow,
and like you had to arrange the food on the tray in a specific pattern, and everything had a ritual to it, and it's just like fun. It's just fun for me.
I agree. Ritual is the thing that ends up. Anytime I'm trying to shift a pattern or a habit or anything like that, I'm saying this broadly. I haven't evaluated all of this, but I feel as though the most effective method for me to do that is with ritual. It's, you know, when it came to like eating healthier and trying to sort of take some more control over my body, intermittent fasting became a wonderful thing, you know, and that I still pick up and drop every once in a while here and there. But it was never really about losing weight or anything. It was this thing like, at this time, I'm going to sit down and have this meal. And, you know, an hour before it, I'd start chopping the vegetables and I'd, you know, like get the olive oil in the pan or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And it was this like, this lead up to,
it's like ecstasy. Being able to do something for yourself that gives you agency within your own life feels really good.
And it's such a simple thing. Yeah. I'm not going to eat between these hours, you know. But to somebody, I mean, food is like a thing that I turn to constantly for I don't know, for not just pleasure, but for, not relaxation, what's the word I'm looking for peace, you know. And it's ironic that so often food is the thing that disrupts my peace, you know, but I for some reason that's been my fixation for most of my life, and so this idea of really taking that kind of control over it and sticking to it and feeling some ownership over my actions on it was transformative.
I couldn't imagine.
So yeah, ritual.
Yeah. I was wanting to ask you, you mentioned that you keep dream journals.
Yes.
And like, why did you start and why is it important to continue? Like, what do you get out of it?
So I started because I read a book about lucid dreaming.
Yeah.
I've always been interested in it. I've had a handful of lucid dreams in my life before it, and they were just phenomenal. Just even though generally very short, I usually couldn't stay in it for very long, but just this concept that there's a realm where I have this power that I seemingly do not have in this material place was fascinating to me. I just thought, how, you know, why wouldn't I learn how to do this? I had a friend in college who I only knew her from being in writing classes together. We would end up in the same seminars because we were both English majors with focus on fiction, and she was always early to class, always had her assignments done ahead of time. She was the opposite of me, you know, but we got along really well and gave each other really good notes. And she started showing up late for class. She missed an assignment. She didn't show up for class once. And so I, the next time I saw her, I said, you know, are you okay? Is everything all right? And she said, yeah, you know, I got to rein this in a little bit, but I've been working toward this for like 5 years and I just mastered lucid dreaming. And now I'm just like sleeping all the time, going to bed all the time. And she told me about how like she has this mansion that she goes to, and she goes up the stairs in the mansion and looks out over a vast swampland, and she'll just conjure up thunder and lightning storms and tornadoes. and then go do whatever, fly over it and do all this stuff. And she was like, how can I'm going to come to class, you know, instead of doing that. Like, and so that sparked my interest. And I finally allowed myself, I shouldn't say allowed myself, I finally had sort of the motivation to read this book. And the book, one of the first things the book recommended before anything else was keep a dream journal. It was a hard start, because there were many nights where I didn't remember dreams or having dreams. But the book recommended you write something down anyways. You know, you write down how you're feeling. You write down... Actually, I'm sorry, I take that back. The book just said try to write something even if you don't remember your dream. So that I determined, like, okay, well, I don't know what to write, so I'm going to write what I'm feeling when I wake up. And I think the purpose behind it was that, just like what we've been talking about, the ritual of waking up and writing something every day shifts our focus, I think. And for me, I felt as though it kind of sent a signal to my awareness that, like, hey, have you noticed that I'm doing this every day? Yeah. I'm really thinking. And the other thing that they recommended was, before going to sleep, you look back at your journal, what you wrote that morning. And then you go to sleep thinking about, you know, I'm going to be aware in my dreams. I'm going to wake up in my dreams. I'm going to stay in my dreams.
Yeah.
And so doing that every night for a while, I would say it probably took about a month, maybe 6 weeks, to where I was having two or three dreams a night, almost five nights a week, you know.
Wow, that's
you
a
know,
lot.
And they'd tell you, you know, the book said, like, if you wake up at 1 a.m, you write it down at 1 a.m. and then go back to sleep. And as a matter of fact, that's even a good way to induce a lucid dream. One of the strategies the book recommended was to set an alarm at like 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. so that you can wake up and then go back to sleep, because you'll have a better chance of kind of...
That's right.
Dipping right
into
the
RA. Or drink a lot of water, like what Darby said.
Yeah, yeah, which I do.
I find that if I wake up like at 3 or 4 a.m. for some reason and I go back to sleep, I have just like wild, intense dreams the rest of the night.
Yes, yeah, for sure. And I think we're having those, because in our sleep cycle, we have, generally, we have 2 rounds of REM. And that deep sleep is generally where we have those dreams. And so that first round of REM is the most likely one to be forgotten, because that's one of the craziest things about dreams to me, is this suspension of reason that, you know, it's me in the dream. I think it feels like me in the dream, so much of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'll sit down and my grandfather, who's been dead since 2001, is there. And I'll be like, oh, hey, how's it going? Having a normal conversation. Whereas, like, if your front door opened and my grandfather walked in right now, I might faint. Yeah. You know, I would totally flip out.
Yeah.
So what is it? You know, it's me, but is it me? Or I have so many little theories jumping around in my head about, like, maybe it's a different me, you know, maybe it's me, but somewhere else, you know, or who knows what. I don't know what it is, but that fascinates me.
Yeah.
But if you wake up and enter back in, especially if you take the time to write out a dream, which sometimes I'm writing like 3 or 4 pages of stuff at like 2 a.m, you're increasing. It really pays. It really pays back, not just in having more dreams and having a better chance maybe of having a lucid dream, but these journals are fascinating. I mean, I go back to some of these, I have no recollection of them almost, you know, except for a handful that were really jarring, but, or important, but it's like reading an adventure that I'm in this adventure. I didn't even know I had this adventure, but I was there. I did this thing. So it feels as though I feel as though I am the most clueless researcher ever known to man, you know, like I almost feel as though it's like observing some particle that behaves in ways that we can't understand, and all we can do is just say, like, well, okay, today it went through a wall and then bounced around and then stuck its tongue out at me. Like, I don't know what this means, but that's what it did.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody one day will understand it, you know? And that's what dreams feel like to me, is like, they seem important enough to be documented.
Yeah.
And I think that there's something to learn in there. And I have some modicum of faith within me that makes me think that, like, well, maybe today's not the day I get it, but maybe one day I'll look back and I'll get it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's why I keep them. I think I feel as though it's important. I feel like it feeds me. And I feel as though it's developing a part of my abilities. It's developing part of my connection with myself, my connection with my mind, or something bigger than my mind. Every time I do it, I feel a little closer. I feel a little bit like, just like with an instrument, like I did my practice today. I did my mechanics.
So there's an aspect to recording your dreams that helps you in your waking day?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think sort of the same as like exercise, you know, when I get up in the morning, like today I got up and I went to the gym and I exercised, and the rest of the day I can tell that there's the physical side of it, that like, okay, I've got these endorphins going through my body, I've got some soreness, I've got this or that, but there's also just sort of this, like, it's like doing your homework right when you get home from school, you know, like, okay, now I get to do anything today. I'm just going to have fun today because I did the hard thing, yeah. You know? And so when I write down the dream, and I know that tonight when I go to bed, I've got two that I wrote last night that I'm going to read. I can't remember what they are right now. And it's like some little, you know, goofy guy left me a fun little story to read before I go to bed tonight. It's like a message for myself.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
I had an experience in my career is very challenging in some ways.
Mm-hmm. I bet.
And I have periods of burnout.
Yes.
And I was going through a pretty bad one, I guess around this time last year, mm-hmm. maybe a little bit afterward. And in my occult studies, like, keeping a dream journal is very important.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure I had the similar struggles that you, like, really, I have to, like, the first thing I have to do is, like, try to wake up enough to write this down.
It's hard.
It's like, I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
But I was having an experience where, like, I would have a dream. It wasn't related to work at all. It was some, my dreams are very, like, psychedelic, out there, weirdly weird stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, if I could remember the dream and think about it even a little bit, just as soon as I woke up, something was shifting in me that was helping me get through this feeling of burnout.
Oh.
And so I started doing like the most tiny version of a dream journal that I could, which is like one weird, funny word or phrase from the dream. I would just write that down. And that was enough to help me remember the dream a little bit more.
Cool.
And I was posting those as, I have a Threads account, and the only thing I used it for was posting those dream words.
Really?
And I didn't keep it up for very long. But the hook of like this weird social media thing being out there and somebody might see it was like rewarding my subconscious enough to help me remember the dreams a little bit better.
That's cool.
So I had a little mini dream journal period that was helping me. Even though the dreams were never related to work directly, it was helping me shift my feelings around my situation in some way. And I don't really understand how or why.
That's cool.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of stories of people working out problems, especially like technical problems in dreams.
That's
as
right.
Well.
Yeah.
There's a great, do you ever listen to, do you ever read or listen to Thomas Campbell?
No.
Well, I don't want to get it wrong. He is somebody who's developing a theory of everything, you know, one of the all encompassing theories to bring everything in. And his one of his basic tenets of the theory, or basic parts of the model, is we are basically avatars in a game. You know, the reality is rendered as we view it, very much like in video games. You know, the like in the new Zelda game, you know, the whole realm isn't rendered. It's only what Zelda or what Link is looking at.
And, yeah.
but he had an experience in meditation and lucid dreaming when he was helping develop like early versions of of coding, when it was still pieces of paper with the
punch card.
Thank you. And he was having trouble with this program that he's creating, and he couldn't figure out what it was, and he was checking and double checking, couldn't figure it out, but it's just literally, you know, thousands upon thousands of these punch cards. And so he had an experience during sort of like a midway between meditation and lucid dream where he started filing through every punch card. It was just kind of like showing up in front of him and then moving on. And all of a sudden, on number, you know, who knows, 460, this card goes through and it's red.
Uh-uh.
And he's like, oh, something weird about card number 460, you know, and he keeps going, and this happens like three more times. And so he goes and he finds those cards, and 460 has got, you know, I can't remember, like, there's some sequence that's wrong on the card. And he finds it again, and finds it again. And then the last card he looks at is perfect. And he thinks, well, this is already incredible. I can't believe that, you know, this actually is accurate. So what? This one isn't wrong. And then he went to go put it back, and he noticed just before he put it back that there was, like, a hanging Chad on the back of the card. And so he, you know, this was this, like, mind-altering moment for him, realizing, oh my gosh, I, you know, there is some information sphere out there that maybe this meditation tapped into, maybe, you know, this lucid dream tapped into. And and you hear stories of different people in history, you know, people who made monumental shifts in our understanding of physics or in basic technology, having these problems that they encounter in dreams that kind of like just get shifted a little bit for them. And when they wake up, like, oh, I never thought about it like that. And they get through it. And I wonder if that's kind of part of this. I'm finding myself developing this very basic sketch of like, I described it to Darby as almost being like different floors in a building where, you know, it's all consciousness, it's all this information sphere, but there's just different ways to view it or different ways to interact with it, maybe some better than others.
Have you come across the terminology of the astral plane or astral projection at all?
Yes. Okay. Yes. And I'm so interested in it, especially with my recent experience.
Like a big part of, so I ended up getting into Damien Eccles. Like he practices broadly within the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very complex system.
Yes.
It takes about a year and a half to become an initiate of it. If you're studying in a group that, and there's like a few around the world, you'll have like a course of study that takes about a year and a half to complete it. And when you're finally initiated into the inner order, this is according to John Michael Greer, who's participated in these groups, you get like a 3-inch thick binder additional material that you study on your own.
Oh my gosh.
And a central metaphor or concept within this tradition is the Kabbalistic Tree of Life.
Yes.
And I've tried to study it. Like I have, for a lot of folks don't know that like the Rider-Waite-Smith tarot deck is based on the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. Like I have 3 tarot decks based on the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, and I have a textbook about it. And I just couldn't get into it. But the reason I'm talking about astral projection and the astral plane is a big part of the practice in the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn is during a conscious state, visualizing yourself along these paths of the Tree of Life, and each path of the Tree of Life maps to a particular major arcana. So like death and the devil and the tower, these are different paths along the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. So you go in a meditative state, you put yourself there, and then you have experiences in that, in the realm of that tarot card.
Wow.
And you might meet entities, supposedly, I never experienced this, that give you insights into how to move. The Kabbalistic Tree of Life is like a map of creation, or the map of human consciousness. It gives you like insights on how to move and advance through that path. And with your like lucid dreaming, and you've had out of body experiences, it seems like that's something that, like, that idea of that kind of meditation, a visualization based meditation, might be something that you'd probably be pretty good at.
Wow. Yeah, that is fascinating. I've never heard that explanation for the Tree of Life, and frankly, I've always been intrigued by it and almost immediately confused by it every time I've tried to read about it or understand it, but it feels too big.
Yeah, it's, and it, I guess for folks who aren't familiar with it, it's like, there's different folks that say that originated with different traditions, but John Michael Greer, who's like a very famous occultist and writer, he's like a researcher. He said, so a lot of folks give the Jewish tradition, the Jewish faith, as the source for the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, but there is a Jewish writer within that tradition that says actually the source is Gnostic Christianity, and the Tree of Life has, like a lot of Western esoteric traditions, is not bound within one religion or within one group of people.
Right.
There's always been cross-pollination. It just so happens that a lot of the development happened within Judaism, and then that development extended within Renaissance era Christians, and that's around the time. And then the tarot got mapped to the Tree of Life later on, by I forget exactly who, but it was folks that predated the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. Wow. So the Tree of Life originally didn't map to the tarot, but that mapping was later added.
I see.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so that's called Kabbalistic pathworking.
Pathworking.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it involves a form of, I guess you could call it, meditation that we in the West, we primarily actually are familiar with Eastern meditation practices, which are mindfulness-based practices.
Right.
There's meditative practices of visualization. You also see those in the Eastern tradition, like within Tibetan Buddhism. But in the Western tradition, there's like meditations where you're projecting images in your mind. There's meditations where you're thinking on a concept, and you're, the focus of your meditation is to come back to that concept and let that concept expand and unfold in your mind.
Oh, okay.
And return to that continuously. I'm kind of on a tangent, but...
No, you've got me.
That's why I love this tradition. It's just so deep. There's so many little wrinkles and pockets and things to explore in it.
Yeah. And I really, I like the same relief that you felt in Buddhism when you were told that you only need to believe what you experience.
Yeah.
In Zen Buddhism. Yeah. Yes, yes.
There are dogmatic branches of Buddhism
right.
too.
And I have a very cursory knowledge of Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, the differences between things like that.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'm wrong all over the place. And that's sort of been the theme of many of my investigations that I've made is not locking into anything in particular, but to sort of, you know, learn and kind of take it in and then let it go. And then a lot of times the stuff that rings the most true to me kind of comes back, and it usually comes back in a way that someone might describe as like synchronicity, where it like kind of hits me back and I'll think, oh wow, you know, that's interesting that just came back to me this way.
Yeah.
And that's what solidifies it within, you know, and I think
like you have an initial exposure and then it kind of like percolates for a while.
Yes.
And then something reconnects you to it or something.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is, I've never been a strong studier, you know, when it comes to, I have a strong drive to consume the information and think about it. And, but if I don't practice it and think about it and practice it and think about it and write about it and do it, it fades, you know, just like a lot of things.
Yeah.
But what I've noticed is these moments where something comes back naturally and hits me in a significant way, it sticks, you know, for a time. Maybe it goes away again, you know, but that it has kind of become my experience and understanding of what I perceive. Again, the term might not be right, but what I perceive to be the Gnostic approach, which is like believing what you experience. So it's you're talking about Zen Buddhism, you know, only having to believe what you experience. And my understanding of Gnosticism, maybe it wasn't Gnostic Christianity, but Gnosticism in general, is this putting your faith only in what you experience and what you see and what feels right, what like brings that, what I refer to sort of as like the buzz. And I think inadvertently I started applying that in my practice. Just, well, if this feels right, then it's going to become belief. And if it doesn't, then I don't have to believe it. It's gone. Totally. You know, it won't be there. And that was really necessary when I, you know, wanted to start watching those alien documentaries or UFO documentaries and things like that. Like I'd be watching some of these things and boy, it would be a real shit show. But entertaining, and I think, okay, well, how am I going to, I don't want to go down this road, you know, but there could be something here, you know. Even that was one of the best lessons I learned from that deep dive, was that like, even some of the documentaries or books or interviews that seem to be really going off the deep end, there is almost always something in there, some nugget that would come out. And I think like, well, that was worth it. That was, you know, even if it wasn't a fact or something that could be verified or anything like that, I would come out of it thinking differently. Maybe that's all that I needed. And I could like, you know, the way I visualize it in my head, and this is kind of how I do a lot of learning in general, is just like there's this immediate comparison in my head to something and I don't know where it comes from, but I think about like chopping vegetables and like these crappy documentaries with, you know, all these people talking about ideas that just are so far beyond what I'm ready to accept. It kind of feels like it's like a vegetable where you like have to cut off so much of it that like by the time you're done, you've got this like pea-sized
like when your cucumbers start getting a little bit soggy or something.
Right. Yeah. You just gotta like, and I almost picture it as like a watermelon that like by the time I get done cutting down to the edible part, it's like, you know, a seed.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, okay.
Do you have a lot of stamina to be able to endure that much, like,
and free time at that yeah. point in my life? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Time to be able to kill.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, what a ride.
Totally.
For sure. But I like hearing where I'm just, I don't want this to go unmentioned, that I really like that you had this intention during this time in the pandemic when you were able to recognize, like, I feel like, you know, I'm imprisoned. I've got better food, I've got more options and everything like that, but I'm experiencing these things that prisoners experience. And then you took the next step of like, well, who's somebody else who's been a prisoner who has gone down this road? I don't know, that kind of just strikes me as a brilliant move, like what a pivot. Yeah. You know, like, and again, it's like, I think inspired pivots like that really do end up paying, you know, or paying sounds dirty, but like end up like giving back so much.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Ultimately, like the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn tradition didn't really speak to me, partly because I have a really hard time like wanting to study and practice Kabbalistic work.
Okay.
Partly because I'm just not in, like, I feel like the same way that I have a hard time perceiving lyrics and songs, I have like zero sensitivity or aptitude for astrology.
Oh, right.
And that's another big part of like, if people don't know anything about Western esoteric tradition, like, they do know astrology, that's part of it, and they do know that the writer Waite-Smith tarot deck.
Yes.
That's a big part of it. That was created by a member of the Hermetic Order, the whole Golden Dawn. But, like, astrology is, like, the one thing that, like, I'm queer, and a lot of my queer friends are, like, 110% into astrology.
Yes.
I go into a party, people are talking about their sign, they ask me my sign, I tell them I don't have one.
Right, okay. And that starts up a real ruckus.
So ultimately, I couldn't really go very deep in those traditions. I went into a related tradition called Thelema that was started by Aleister Crowley.
Yeah, Aleister Crowley.
Because there were active teachers around the time of the pandemic lockdowns that were, like, very visible in communities and had, like, a buzz around them. And I liked Damien, but I wanted something a little bit more rigorous and detailed.
Okay.
Damien's good because he's able to, like, strip down the complexity and give you something that you can work with.
Yes.
But my mind likes to go into all the little nooks and crannies, and I found somebody that could do that. So I got into Thelema, but Thelema has Kabbalistic pathworking and astrology as well. And recently I found, so John Michael Greer, he's super prolific. He, like, publishes multiple books a year. He translates from Latin. He's edited, like, The Black Brick, which is this, like, enormous tome of the Hermetic Golden Dawn writings.
Wow.
He's been archdruid of multiple druidry traditions. Wow. And anyway, he created this, like, very minimalist system, because traditions are systems. They have different components that you study concurrently, and they all help each other, where I don't object to any of the components separately. It's like, oh, I don't have to know astrology, I don't have to get into Kabbalistic path working. There's meditation, I love meditation. There's sacred geometry, I don't know what that is, but I like the idea that I'm going to draw figures and learn about that. And so I've been getting into that, and this is the first time since I was a Buddhist where, like, I feel like I'm on a path where I can continue growing. And eventually, there are no groups in this tradition. He created basically, like, an open source, like, traditionless tradition where you teach yourself and then you initiate yourself.
Oh, cool.
And you can plug in religion into it. Like, it's not religious. It doesn't have any magic. It's all about developing sensitivity to your own mind, to the universe, which, and less so about changing the universe.
You just read my mind. That was my next question.
Yeah. So it doesn't have magic. Like,
yes.
Like, within the Western esoteric tradition, magic is, like, one definition is, like, the science, art and science of changing consciousness in accordance with will. Like, it doesn't contain a magical component. It's just very minimalist, but you can plug in magical components if you want to. And that's what I've been getting really into. And that's partly why I wanted to talk with you, is because I feel inspired into a spiritual tradition in a similar way that I did, like, 15 years ago in Buddhism.
Yes.
For the first time since then. So I'm kind of, like, in a honeymoon phase.
Yeah.
Which I haven't been, and it feels really exciting. So
that is really exciting.
Yeah.
I have enough questions for, like, five more sit downs with you. I'm excited for you, by the way. I mean, that's a really, I think I know a version of that excitement that you're in, and it's such a good place to be. And I want to know more about it. And,
are we, like, have we talked for, like, an hour and a half or 2 hours or something?
Oh, I don't know. I've lost track of time. I think it's like an hour and a half or so.
Okay.
I don't care. I mean, but I'm definitely more on, like, your schedule.
I could keep going a little bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things that you just said that was reading my mind was, you know, when it comes to this practice, I think a lot of people hear, you know, occult, they hear
I literally have a book that that teaches you how to summon demons.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's where people's mind goes.
Right.
There's exactly. Anything weird you can, like, the deepest, weirdest stuff, the most out there stuff, it's there.
And it's there.
And you can like study it, and there's books, and there's like people that want to talk to you about it online.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think, okay, so now more questions. Okay, so like when it comes to that, like, okay, so I get a book that teaches me how to summon a demon. Is it your belief that the book actually has some objective form of ritual that will do it? Or is it the job of the book to be convincing enough that you believe it? And because you believe it, that is what allows you to do it.
Yeah. This is a debate that happens a lot within the occult tradition.
Okay.
There's a group called the Ordo Templi Orientalis, or OTO.
Yes.
Are you familiar with it?
Yeah.
So for those who aren't familiar, Aleister Crowley started this group like in the early 20th century. It died out, and it was kind of brought back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. One of the like main figures in that, Dr. David Shoemaker, he's great. He's got great lectures on podcasts, and he writes great books. His approach is very psychological.
Okay.
He studied Jungian psychology. Jungian psychology has an element of like spiritualism,
for sure,
spirituality and occult in it. But like, he doesn't go on podcasts and say that, like, yes, he's like summoned a spirit and he's seen it materialize like you and I look physical to each other. He doesn't go on and say that he can do that. But there are people that do. And there's some people for whom magic is a purely internal psychological thing. And then there are people who might have different senses than I do that have experienced that they claim to have been able to like do really magical things, like summon a being and like see it like physically manifest,
right. You know? Yeah.
And to add to your question, the most of the occult books that I've read are basically like, okay, if you do these practices and you do them long enough and you study them and you get help from a teacher, if you get stuck, eventually you will get some result.
Mm.
The result will vary on the individual.
Right. That, I mean, I think that has been my reasoning going into all of this. One of the early things that kind of hit me was, or that like came to rest in me, was this concept that my belief was the greatest indicator of anything that happens, right? Like, and really stripping down the concept of belief, like truly, if, like, for example, if I truly believed that you didn't exist,
yeah,
and you were not sitting there in front of me,
right,
truly believed it,
yeah,
then would you disappear from this room right now?
Yeah.
You know, would my eyes not perceive you because my belief was so strong, right? And so in that case, my reality would, my truth would be that you're not here, right?
Yeah.
And so if I can believe so strongly that I can conjure you to be here,
yeah,
you know, then I could, you know, is it equally strong in that other direction, right? And that's what I kind of go back and forth thinking about this tradition that you and I are discussing, this one where I feel a little bit, at least so far, I feel less connected to imposing my will on anything.
Yeah.
And more connected to the desire to observe differently, to see more, but not interfere.
Yeah.
And there is that there's a safety in that for me. There's a safety not just in practice, but there's a safety in feeling as there for me at least. And I believe that there's a chance that this changes on the individual based on intent or desire or anything like that. For me to inflict my will using something like magic to make something work the way I want it to. I need to get some money, so I'm going to make money come to me, yeah. or something like that. Almost feels as though it's a violation. It almost feels like I'm doing something wrong. Now, there might be people out there who do that, and it's for the greater good, and it's the way things should be, or I'm not really sure where I fall on that. But but for me, I find myself more attracted to, or at least when I say attracted to, like a magnetic attraction, not necessarily like, ooh, that's cool, I'm going to go over there. I find myself led more than trailblazing. You know, my experiences that I've had that seem beyond the realm of normalcy, I feel as though I had a bit of a hand in it. You know, I didn't abort. You know, I kept on going forward, but it felt very much as though something else was like leading me there.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I wonder about certain concepts like there's that B.F. Skinner concept about intermittent reward, where, you know, if you want to change a person or an animal's behavior, you don't give a reward every single time they do the behavior, because if you do that, then the behavior gets done just to get the reward, and eventually the behavior goes away and they go back to the way they were. But if you give reward intermittently, like without pattern, you know, to where they don't know, you know, when they're going to get rewarded for this thing, they're more likely to continue doing that practice. And sometimes it kind of feels like that's what I'm in. You know, sometimes with meditation, I'll go, you know, a month and I'm not getting that feeling. And I think like, what's going on? And all of a sudden it's back, you know, yeah. Or I can't tell you how many times I've felt the beginnings of what feels like it's going to be an out of body experience, this buzzing feeling in me and this like resonance in my chest and my head. And it really gets intense. And then it's like, nope. Not today, you know, and it goes away. And just the experience of that resonance is wonderful. It's like going on a roller coaster. So it's not like I am disappointed, but it's not like I'm left without anything. But I wonder if that's sort of the fact that that element exists in it almost feels as though there's some kind of, I don't know, dare I say, like a control system in place or something, some sort of...
like something that's allowing you to occasionally have some moment of connection with the universe, but doesn't allow you to have it all the time.
Right.
And that makes it's like deliberately doing it so that it stays precious and desirable or something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Which I don't know, you know, if I took it into my own hands... I wonder if it would become mundane. You know, I don't know. It would be hard to make it mundane, but I wonder, you know, as opposed to like this thing that sometimes happens to me.
Yeah.
And then it works, you know, all of a sudden this thing happens and I am like lit up and you can't stop me. I'm going in, you know, whatever direction, I'm motivated and energized. What a shame it would be if it did become mundane. I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. I went out of body again. Interacted with
this entity. I'm trying to think if there's something like that in my life where it felt like impossible to achieve and then it became regularly achievable. I guess, I think being a musician is kind of like that actually.
Yes.
I don't have like a super deep classical background, like I said, I didn't practice 4 hours a day when I was a little kid, but if you hand an adult a cello and ask them to play a scale on it, and they've never played cello before, it's just like really, it's not going to sound good at all,
right?
And so being able to play cello at like the most basic fundamental twinkle 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 little star level, that requires an adult that has time to practice, like maybe a year of study, continuous study. And then at the end of that, they have a power that like 99.9% of the population doesn't have.
Yeah.
But they've achieved it so gradually that by the time they achieve it, it's no longer a magic power anymore.
Mm. Right. And then you end up having this mental dance of somebody saying to you, like, oh, you're so talented. And you say, why are you telling me I'm talented? Yeah. Why aren't you complimenting this person who I think is more talented than me?
Yeah. That's right. So, yeah, I think maybe we're like a lot of the things that help us move through the world, like we become experts in, but then we lose a connection to how special that actually is.
Yeah, I think so too.
So don't become an expert at lucid dreaming.
I won't do it. I haven't, you know, it's funny. I've been doing it for years and years and years. Yeah. And I still, I would say my frequency is about the same as far as the lucid dreaming. But there are these other effects, I think. I don't know. I think it's, I keep doing it for some reason.
Yeah.
You know.
And I practice, I practice scales on the upright bass that I don't think I'll ever be able to pull off live.
Mm.
But trying to do something that feels impossibly hard feels rewarding for some reason.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a setting yourself with a challenge that that idea is something that's hard for me a lot. You know, I can get overwhelmed with a big challenge very quickly.
Yeah.
And there are these moments in my life sometimes where I just say yes to something, even though it's a big challenge. And I think, like, what have I done? What have I done?
Yeah.
Have you, and it's totally fine if this is too personal, but have you had experiences that sort of propelled you more into this tradition, this esoteric tradition, that, or at least have you had experience that sort of like solidified your belief in them because, like, okay, I've seen it or I've felt it?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I haven't seen entities. I haven't had really intense mystical experiences. I had some experiences as a little kid.
Okay.
But nothing as an adult. And what, I think part of me getting the Zen was that, okay, I feel good when I meditate. It's very minimalist. It requires discipline. There's just one thing you have to master. Mm. But that was a way to, and I would judge people that would jump from thing to thing.
Yes.
Like it was Zen this week, and then it's Hinduism the next week, and they're going to maybe check out Hare Krishna, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I would judge the people that were like too flighty or lacking in discipline, and so part of the reason I burned out on Zen was because, like, I was imposing this like really harsh discipline on myself. Mm-hmm. And I actually did need variety, and I did need novelty, like, for lack of a better term.
Sure.
And so getting into these systems where you can get within Buddhism, there's so many different types of Buddhism. Vajrayana Buddhism, which includes Tibetan Buddhism, is the opposite. It's like there's so many different bodhisattvas and different kinds of meditations and visualizations. There's like they talk a lot about the, you know, reincarnation and like all these practices to accelerate your awakening. It's super colorful. It's super dense. Even like the westernized versions of it, like Shambhala Buddhism, there's like all these different trainings you can go to, all these different classes,
right,
all these different stages. So that exists within Buddhism. But I, at the time that I was a Buddhist, I was like, no, that's that fluffy stuff. Like, that's not me. But within this tradition, I can get that. I can get that, like, that feeling of novelty. Like, I'm doing John Michael Greer's system, which is called Way of the Golden Section. And once I complete the initiation, then it says, okay, you've completed the initiation. Now go on your own and learn other occult systems and integrate them.
Wow.
So I like to constantly learn new stuff, and so this is a tradition where I can express that side of myself.
And you will never, I don't think you'll ever run out of stuff to learn.
That's right. Yeah. And it's always being extended. Like, it's a very living tradition. There's stuff, a lot of these practices are rooted in very ancient practices, or our ideas of very ancient practices, because they can be reconstructions.
Right.
But then there's a lot of contemporary stuff that arises. Like there's a documentary about Pepe the Frog. I don't know if you've checked that out.
I know that. Yeah. Is that the sort of like
the alt-right?
Right.
Where they talk about the occult practices that happen on 4chan. And John Michael Greer was actually a guest on that documentary. And
really?
He was talking about like the chaos magic that was done on 4chan to bring about the election of Donald Trump. So there's like occultism is constantly evolving, even within like technological spaces. And so,
wow.
So yeah, it'll never stagnate, I don't think.
That's right. Yeah. It can adapt to almost anything.
Yeah.
Right. And I feel as though like so many of these occult traditions, I mean, it's a little late in the episode to point this out, but occult just means secret, you know.
Hidden.
Yeah, or that's right. Hidden is better. Yeah. I feel as though a lot of people who aren't versed in this hear occult and they just hear cult.
That's right.
So many of these occult traditions are so deeply rooted in different cultures and different just different. Folklore and different, you know, and so
we've been talking mostly about like a traditions of like learned peoples of people that were literate.
Yes.
There's, like you mentioned, there's like all the earth-based religions like druidry and what we call nowadays witchcraft and shamanism and yeah, that's like an entirely other thing that I could get into one day. But my analytic brain loves to read stuff with complicated diagrams, so I'll probably stay with this stuff.
Well, I just think like just looking at this as a form of study or research, it's so expanding. You know, you learn so much about different countries' histories, different cultural histories, just to understand references within it, which is part of what overwhelms me going into it. I started reading Umberto Eco's Foucault's Pendulum recently, and it just makes so many casual references to terms and traditions that I'm going to need like a companion book to go through it. Even though even not knowing what he's talking about sometimes is still fascinating.
Yeah.
That I think is one of the things that kind of made me hesitate a lot when I was first getting into this. Is like, well, geez, if I'm going to understand this, I'm going to have to know the whole history of this.
It's daunting. And like within the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, if you complete the course of study, you've done as much work as a person completing a PhD. It's that deep.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And that's not something I want to do.
Right. Yeah,
I've been to grad school once, so that's enough for me. I would recommend for like learning, like I like finding books that give you like a broad survey.
Yes.
They go into a little bit of depth. They give you a lot of context. Mitch Horowitz wrote a book called Modern Occultism.
Yes.
And,
okay.
And he's been a guest on many podcasts. I really like him because he's fully into scientific validation of ideas,
yes.
But also fully into validating the experiences of people.
Mm.
And so that's like a survey of occultism from the past to the present. And then also just for like an overview of like the different magical practices within occultism, there's a book called Ceremonial Magic by Lon Milo Duquette and Dr. David Shoemaker. And it's basically, they got submissions for different authors in different traditions of like, this is magic in John Dee's system. This is magic in Thelema. This is magic in a druidic reconstruction context. And each chapter is by a different author. And then they edit it all together.
Wow. So okay, cool.
And that's fun because it has like all the weird diagrams from John Dee. You really feel like oh cool, this is actual like witchcraft or whatever, you know.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Yeah,
that's perfect. I was going to ask for recommendations, not just for myself but for anybody who's listening and wants to know. I think that's one of the first places we go. It's like you've gone through the thickets and made a path, like which way do I go?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
and I can lend those to you if you want to. So
okay.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah.
Can we do this again sometime?
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Okay, cool. Even without a microphone, it's fine.
Yeah, but, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you so much. I usually like to ask, in general, like, do you it's pretty late, you know, already, but do you, your day's ended now. Like once I pack up my stuff and I go, like you're done. Like, do you, what are you going to, how are you going to treat yourself? Like what's.
So recently I like to, even though it's terrible for my sleep, I like to watch videos before I go to bed.
Yeah.
I do and for some reason, I'm so glad I discovered it now, but for some reason I never watched Adventure Time.
Oh, right.
And so I'm like, this has existed for like 10 years and I didn't know about it.
And that is so steeped with symbolism.
Yeah, they directly mention Crowley. They directly are inspired. Like, I don't know, there's the Peppermint Butler character is doing ritual magic, kind of inspired by what we've been talking about.
Interesting.
Like the author, writers of that show knew about this stuff.
For sure.
Yeah.
And the animators are the ones who animated Midnight Gospel, which
That's correct.
Is one of the first recommendations you gave me, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm going to treat myself. I always like have a little like pre-bed snack and I'm watching Adventure Time. That's what I'm going to do.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Colin.
Yeah. Wow. I absolutely loved that conversation. Listening back to it has been such a pleasure. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I really want to thank John David for all the effort, intention, and enthusiasm they put forward for this episode. As I mentioned earlier, I've had multiple opportunities to hear John David play music, and it's always been wonderful. I've only just recently had the opportunity to play in a band with them. And the two of us got to take part in Jacob Adams' project, Them, which consisted of John David, Chris Hillman, Mark Archer, Jacob Adams, and me. It's a really incredible set of songs that Jacob wrote that the band got to take part in arranging and performing, and we even got to record some of them in the studio, and that recording will be released soon, so keep your ears and eyes open for that. However, my experience with John David and the band was so pleasant because, as I mentioned, they came so prepared. They came with sheet music written out, they came with ideas for the songs, additions, subtractions, middle sections. They were so willing to listen to other people's ideas, yes, and those ideas, to try out those things. Very, very wonderful dynamic to create in a band, especially when you're working with new people, you know, when you're working with new music. It was just a very pleasant experience in that respect. My experience with sitting down for this discussion was very similar. I arrived at John David's house and they had, you know, the kitchen table ready for us to sit down. They had a notebook with all these ideas jotted down in it, you know, questions to ask and different avenues for us to go down if we needed it. And it was, of course, just in case. It was there in case we needed it. We ended up sitting down and talking about music for an hour before we even got into some of those things that they prepared. But it's just such a nice experience to have another person go all in on an idea that means something to me. Just this past weekend, I got some great feedback from my friends Jason and Beth, who listened to an episode for the first time, and they started off with a Lexi Bronze episode, so they didn't really know what the show was, and they pointed out to me that I don't really tell people what the show is in the opening of the show or in the closing of the show. I never really explain what we do in Find a Way. And so they suggested, why not add an opening line or two that helps people understand what this podcast is? And it was a great suggestion. You know, I really appreciated it. At first, I thought, well, do I need that? It's kind of nice just going into a conversation. But the more I thought about it, I thought, well, I might as well try it. You know, there's no harm in giving it a go. And so it was a great prompt for me to kind of think about, what is this podcast? What am I doing here? What is the overall point? And so I really have to thank Jason and Beth for not just for listening, but also for thinking about it and taking it seriously enough that they thought, you know, this could be improved because it's worth improving. And I know on top of all of that gratitude that I've got, there's further gratitude just for the fact that giving feedback like that can be hard to do. You know, I've had people reach out and I can hear the hesitation in their voice when it comes to giving that suggestion, because some people don't react well to feedback. Some people don't react well to constructive criticism. And certainly in my life, I have not reacted well to constructive criticism before. That's for sure. Thankfully, I think I've gotten much better at it, and it's only benefited me. And so I'm entering a phase of my life where I'm seeing my ability to receive feedback as a strength. And so for that, I am also very grateful. So thank you, Jason and Beth. Thank you to all of you who have reached out and supported the show. Thank you all of you who have shared the show with your friends and your family. And of course, thank you just for listening in the first place. That's the only thing that I hope I can rely on you for consistently is just to come back and listen. So thanks again, John David. John David will return if it's up to me. It's up to me. John David's coming back. And we will talk more and more and go deeper and deeper. In the meantime, I'm going to sign off. I'm going to leave you with one of John David's original songs. This song is called Passage. It is the result of a collaboration with aerialist Cassie Catania, and it is dedicated to John David's father, Fred Erickson. You can find more of John David's music on Bandcamp under John David Erickson. Erickson is spelled E-R-I-K-S-E-N. Check it out. Come back and listen again. In the meantime, I hope you're well, and I hope you find your way to some happiness in the following weeks. Thanks again.